Welcome to the Deep Dive. So today, we're looking at something maybe a bit unexpected. Japanese playing cards, Onofuda, the flower cards. And for you, the listener, this isn't just about a game. It's really a story of how culture, well, travels. How it changes and finds new life, often thousands of miles from where it started.
It really is a fascinating journey. And it all kicks off with, believe it or not, Portuguese traders back in the mid-1500s. They brought playing cards to Japan.
Right. But they didn't last long, did it?
No, not at all. Pretty quickly, by 1633, Japan slammed the doors shut. The Sokoku period, the isolation policy.
Okay.
And that meant foreign goods, including playing cards, were a big no-no, strictly banned.
So the game basically had to go underground to survive. Is that the idea?
Exactly. And that's kind of key to its later life. To get around the ban, players started making the designs more and more abstract. Less, obviously, foreign playing cards.
Making them harder to recognize.
Yeah, sometimes even disguising them as utagaruta, which are traditional Japanese poetry cards. Very different thing visually. It was all about avoiding trouble.
So it developed this sort of secret identity from the get-go.
Precisely. That hidden, almost subversive nature, it set the stage for how it would adapt later when Japanese people emigrated.
And then, fast forward a bit, someone had to actually make these cards once things loosened up, right?
Right. And this is the part everyone finds amazing. The company founded in 1889 to mass produce these decks, these Hanafuda cards.
Let me guess.
Nintendo Kōpai. Kōpai just meaning card company.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the Nintendo video games Mario started with these little paper flower cards designed to fool the police. That's kind of wild.
It really is. Necessity and invention, you know?
Okay, so from Japan, let's follow the migration path. Late 1890s, Japanese workers head to Korea. And the cards go with them. And they change again there, right? It becomes Watu.
Yeah, Watu, the flower battle. And the change isn't just the name. It's physical, too. Those delicate Japanese paper cards.
Yeah.
They get replaced with these thick, sturdy little plastic tiles. Much more durable. You can snap them down on the table.
Okay, so they're built to last. What about the game itself?
The dominant game in Korea is Go Stop. And that name tells you a lot. It introduces this crucial mechanic.
Go Stop.
Right. You reach a winning score and you have a choice. You can stop. Take your points, guaranteed win for the round, or you can risk it.
You can go.
You go for it. Try to score even more, potentially multiply your winnings. But if you fail or someone else wins first, you could lose everything you'd already banked in that round.
Adds a whole layer of psychology, I bet. Risk assessment.
Totally changes the feel. And what's really fascinating is the cultural shift. In Japan, Hanafuda had, let's say, strong ties to gambling, even the Yakuza.
Right, the underground image again.
But in Korea, Watu becomes this beloved family game, played everywhere during big holidays like Lunar New Year, Chuseok. It's noisy, it's social.
Quite the turnaround. From shady backrooms to the family living room.
A complete flip. Mm-hmm. It was even used subtly for political satire during some periods. Okay, so from Korea, let's hop across the Pacific.
To Hawaii.
To Hawaii, yeah. Japanese immigrants working on the sugar plantations brought the cards, inspiring local games like Sakura.
And did it change again there?
Oh, yes. And this is where it gets really interesting, I think. They didn't just tweak the rules. They went further.
How
so? Symbolic replacement. They started creating decks like Napua Hawaii Hawaiian flowers, where they swapped out the traditional Japanese plants and symbols for local Hawaiian ones.
So actually changing the pictures on the cards.
Exactly. Replacing the traditional seasonal flowers with endemic Hawaiian plants, embedding local stories, the mulalo.
Can you give an example? Like, what replaced what?
Sure. So January in Hanafuda is usually pine, a symbol of longevity. In some Hawaiian decks, that gets replaced by a hinahina, the silver sword, a unique plant found only on Haleakala and Mauna Kea, very specific to Hawaii.
Wow. Okay, another one.
May. Traditionally, that's iris. In Hawaii, it might become kalo taro, which is, you know, absolutely central to Hawaiian culture, diet, history. It's a staple food, deeply significant.
So they're essentially remapping the game onto the Hawaiian landscape and culture.
Precisely. And newer decks, like one called Hanafuda Pilina, Pilina means connection or unity, they explicitly use the game for cultural education.
Connecting younger generations, maybe born in Hawaii, to both their Japanese and their Hawaiian heritage.
That's the goal. It becomes this bridge. The game itself, the act of playing, it's like a nonverbal language.
That's a great way to put it.
For older generations, it's nostalgia, maybe a connection to their own youth or parents. For younger folks, it's a way into heritage they might not, you know, speak the language of fluently. It connects them physically, socially.
So wrapping this up, What's the big takeaway here?
Yeah.
What does this journey of, well, just a deck of cards tell us?
I think it beautifully demonstrates that culture isn't some static object you put in a museum case. It's not frozen.
It's alive.
It's alive, absolutely. It breathes, it adapts, it travels, it picks up new meanings, new contexts, even when it's really far from its original home. It keeps evolving.